Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School as I record this show, as the show is being recorded in late May. By the time you hear this show, I will have left the resident fellow position and be a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School and an assistant professor at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Today, I'm very excited to have on the author of an interesting book that goes somewhat in directions that we've discussed on the show, but in other significant ways, quite different. The author of the book is Ben Clemens, and the book is Math You Can't Use, Patents, Copyright, and Software. In this book, Ben hits on one of the very challenging and very hot issues right now in patent law, which is the question of the patentability of software. And Ben's take on that particular issue is what we're going to be discussing today, because Ben looks at it from the standpoint of mathematics. Mathematics, of course, being the basis upon which software is written and indeed the basis upon which science is performed. And indeed, in Ben's book, he looks at the question of ownership of mathematical equations and what that means. In Ben's view, and I'll let Ben explain in more detail, what we're dealing with here is a question of owning mathematics and propertizing mathematics and ultimately controlling the use of mathematics. So in Ben's book, Math You Can't Use, Patents, Copyright, and Software, we take a very close look at these questions. Ben is a guest scholar at the Center on Social and Economic Dynamics at the Brookings Institution, where he writes programs to perform quantitative analyses and policy-oriented simulations. He also consults for the National Institute of Health, and previously he consulted for the World Bank on Intellectual Property in the Developing World. He received his PhD from the California Institute of Technology. So we're talking to someone who has a PhD in the area, but who is not a lawyer. And that's one of the many challenges, I think, when we're dealing with these issues, is that because technology and law are increasingly intertwingled, to use a word that Peter Morville, in his book Ambient Findability, another guest on the show, has discussed. We're dealing with a lot of questions that are quite interdisciplinary. I am not a mathematician. I did take math, of course, in high school. I think I avoided it in college. I did take statistics, but numbers have not been my best friend, although I could say that I don't live in total fear of them. But I'm a bit of a neophyte, and so I'm looking forward to chatting with Ben about the mathematical underpinnings of software and indeed about his views in his book regarding intellectual property rights thereabout. So you'll hear, if you're listening to the show live on KZSU, quite a few songs here that focus on numbers. The first song you heard was Pi, off Kate Bush's most recent album. The next one is a pretty well-known song. I don't think I need to introduce it much. So we're going to take a short music break, and when we return from the break, we'll chat with Ben Clemens, author of the book Math You Can't Use, Patents, Copyright, and Software.
Hopefully on the other end of the line today, we have Ben Clemens. Ben, are you there?
Hi there.
Ben, thanks for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Let's start right off with the question that I ask all of my guests. This one may be a little bit more obvious than some of the other titles we've discussed, but the title of your book, what it means and why you wrote this book.
Well, I guess as you mentioned, you know, I make a link between mathematics and computer code, which has, I'm not the first one to make this. The first people to make this link probably would have been, you know, Turing and Church, two mathematicians who were working at the beginning of the century. So what we have here, from my view, is sort of a first in human history, which is that we're allowing people to own mathematical algorithms, own methods of processing information. And my interest in this came from a couple of directions. Although I'm not a lawyer, I've spent way too much time reading law books,
and, which it sounds like you've enjoyed every moment of it.
It can be fun. It can be fun in that most math there's always one answer. You do the logic and you're done. And in law you can do the logic one way and you get answer A. You do the logic the other way, you get answer B. I think that's enthralling. But,
as a mathematician, does that, well, you said it's enthralling, so maybe the follow-up, I don't mean to interrupt you, is that exciting to you, or did you find it frustrating at times?
Well, I think it's interesting that, you know, how one comes up with the law books are filled with a procedure for every step along the way. And, you know, over time we've developed all of these rules to handle the fact that one could argue one way and get one result and argue the other way and get another result. Part of why I wrote Math You Can't Use, by the way, my interest in software patents is, I don't think this is such a case. You can approach this from many directions. You can look at the legal history up to the present day. You can look at the economic situation. You could do this sort of ethical question of, you know, how should we treat mathematics? And all of these things point in the same direction and say that software should not be patentable. So I took some comfort in that before I was doing some amount of work on immigration law, mm-hmm. which there is no right answer. There never will be.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, please.
Do you find in looking at these issues, I've asked this of a number of guests who've been on who are not lawyers but are dealing with the law. What did you find as a non-lawyer dealing with this intersection of your discipline and the law to be the most challenging issue to deal with and to overcome?
Well, if I can read challenging as frustrating.
Sure.
I think my big frustration is sort of there is an insularity and almost a level of disrespect between different groups. So patent lawyers have a bit of disdain for people who are not patent lawyers, and computer scientists have a bit of disdain for people who are not computer scientists, and so on and so forth. Of course, the people who are writing the law are are attorneys, and so they almost have disrespect for, quote, the /dot crowd, end quote, who disagree. And the funny thing about software patents versus many, many other laws, and you can probably find other comparable examples, is that programmers didn't really want it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
There were only a handful of programmers who in 1994 wanted software to be patentable. And as a result, it was sort of imposed on the field by the legal system, which I think was kind of an interesting event. But but here in the present day, you still have a lot of programmers who think that this is a terrible idea, and they're completely ignored. I've read many lawyers, and they have great disdain for these folks. I've talked to folks on Capitol Hill in congressional aides, and I say, what if tomorrow somebody posted on /dot, you know, write to you, Mr. Congressman, and you got 10,000 emails saying, you know, these software patents are a bad idea, what would you do? And congressional aide says, they're just programmers.
I think it would be useful for listeners, because I want to delve into the political aspects of this, given the fact that you're at Brookings and that you've testified on these issues and discussed them with people in Congress. Where, in a nutshell, would you say the focus of your book is? What the intersection of math and patents, for the benefit of the listeners, where is that intersection, and how does that fit into the issues involving software?
Well, I guess that one way to think about it is, instead of talking about numbers or software, we can talk about information processing.
Okay.
And in that case, we're talking about patents on processing of information. So these are no longer physical objects. We're talking about an algorithm that takes in a bunch of numbers or a list of names and spits out another bunch of numbers or list of names. And this is sort of the new concept behind the software patent. And so that much of the book discusses that very subject and the question of how this has affected the world.
The world of Mathematics is one that, as I mentioned in the introduction, we have not discussed on the show. And so maybe, again, this is rudimentary for you, but I think for listeners that aren't familiar with software, how does, at its core level, how does mathematics build the software that we're discussing broadly in this book?
Well, mathematics is basically the language of information processing. You come up with a long string of algorithms. You know, you take in some list of numbers and you put out another list of numbers. And if you want to make those numbers social security numbers, you get one result. You have one application. If you want to make them, frequencies of genetic markers, you have another application, etc. So that's one of the key differences between mathematics and the processing of information and many other inventions. So when we talk about a physical device like a stapler, as you can see, I'm staring at the desk right now. I've got a stapler and a tape dispenser, and both of them have very specific uses. And you can think of other devices like a hammer that have more general uses. But all a hammer does is bang things. But other algorithms, such as maybe a regression algorithm, can be applied in all sorts of fields all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read to you my favorite quote from Donald Knuth.
Sure.
For those who don't know Donald Knuth, he's sort of one of the considered to be one of the founders of modern computer science. He didn't like how his Art of Computer Science was being typeset by the publisher, so he wrote new typesetting software from scratch. He's that kind of guy.
That's one way to solve the problem.
It's great software. People still use it, including me. Knuth explains, it is not possible to distinguish between numerical and non-numerical algorithms, as if numbers were somehow different from other kinds of precise information. All data are numbers. All numbers are data. Mathematicians work much more with symbolic entities than with numbers. Hmm. So Knuth's point there is, I'm in concurrence with Knuth here in saying that mathematics is about information processing, regardless of what that information is.
The software aspect of this, then, you define it in the beginning of your book, and I think it's an interesting definition. So I think you're leading into it. How do you define software in light of that view?
So I've made clear the information processing part of it. The other part that's relevant is that there's very little knowledge of any physicality in a software, quote, invention, end quote. You don't have to know anything about the machine. And that also has a major effect, because in order to, say, develop a new drug, you need to know an awful lot of chemistry. You need to know an awful lot about, how to build machines that will process chemicals, etc. But in order to develop, incredibly advanced algorithms about processing information, all you need is, the PC you have on your desk now. This expands the scope of a software design still further, because here at Brookings we have an entire floor of one building devoted to the IT department, and I'm guessing you have a computer in the room right now.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right?
Yes, you do. You are correct. In fact, there's more than one.
Yes, and all of the listeners as well, they're looking around the room thinking, oh, I guess I do. Half of the ones in their car right now are have a PC in the passenger seat or something.
Right. Well, especially in the Bay Area, yes.
Yeah. Conversely, Brookings has absolutely no resources for synthesizing pharmaceuticals. We have no resources for, mass-producing plastic toys or what have you. So the information processing industry doesn't exist. It's everybody. It's all of us. Every company in the world processes information.
Mm-hmm.
But then every company, the companies that synthesize pharmaceuticals or make staplers or what have you, it's a defined market of maybe a dozen, maybe 100 individual companies. So this also has a big effect on what happens when we propertize the information processing.
The which leads us into, I guess, your core thesis, and I'll let you expand on it or even correct me if you think I'm simplifying it too much. But to boil it down, I think your core argument is that software itself, using that term, and I recognize how the holistic approach that you're taking with respect to information, but to use the term software is math. Math isn't patentable, so therefore software shouldn't be patentable. Let's talk a little bit about that thesis, but first perhaps it would be useful to talk about just the basic idea of why math itself isn't patentable. And I recognize that you're not a lawyer, so I'm not asking you to discuss it as a lawyer would, but based upon your research in the book, how is that conclusion drawn?
Sure. I to some extent, we will go over the case law as well. But let us begin in India, say around 600 BCE. This guy Pythagoras, journeys, he went to India and picked up a few principles of the philosophy of the world at large. One of the pieces he picked up was that there exists this sort of ideal which we can't quite perceive that is represented by number. Plato picked up on this as well and said that there's this Platonic ideal out there, and when we study mathematics, we get a glimpse of it. In fact, he said that when you learn mathematical theorems, you're actually being reminded of them because they're inherent to all of us. And the Platonic philosophy actually held sway for centuries and was unquestioned. The philosophy said mathematics is not something that we invented. It's something that is just inherent to the universe. It's something that no one person, comes up with or invents or owns. This was true up until let's say the late 1700s. I'm very bad with dates. I can't be precise on this.
Fair enough. We'll use ballpark.
Okay, the late 1700s. We started to see the development of non-Euclidean geometry, and in non-Euclidean geometry, you're back to this, almost back to our lawyers, where side A says, here are our axioms, here's our conclusion. Side B says, here are our axioms, here's the conclusion, and they'll contradict. And, of course, it's a question of which axioms you choose to accept. And for some situations, different axioms make sense. But this led to an opening of maybe mathematics isn't inherent to the universe. Maybe it's just a question of shunting symbols around. And there's no answer to the question, is mathematics an invention or a discovery? But I think most mathematicians, 100% of the mathematicians I've spoken to, see it more as a question of discovering than inventing. Now let's look at the U.S. and U.S. law.
Mm-hmm.
The first patent law was written by Mr. Thomas Jefferson in the late 1700s, about 1780. And so we're still in the world where math is a discovery and not an invention. And that law was very broadly written, and basically it's a sentence. That sentence remains in law today. That basically says, whoever invents a machine, manufacture, process, or composition of matter can get a patent for it. But everyone top to bottom understood certain exceptions from this very broad listing of patent law, of what is patentable. And the key to that was laws of nature. Laws of nature may not be patented. So when Einstein came up with his law of relativity, he could not patent it, even though, it was a brilliant concept. It's in every other way. It's something that, you would want to protect by patent law. When new elements are discovered, they may not be patented. And to some extent, it's an economic justification saying, you know, these are basic principles. How do you avoid, you know, how do you avoid infringing on a patent on, you know, nature? And second, there's sort of an ethical bent to this thing. You know, no one person should have ownership of nature.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, so now we get to the big question, which is mathematics a part of nature or a separate thing? And up until about the mid-1990s, courts generally agreed, no, it's a part of nature, and therefore it should not be subject to patentability. And then we saw a change in the mid-90s, where people said, well, it's a part of nature by itself, purely in the abstract, but as soon as it's applied to the real world, it becomes a quotidian invention like any other. You were saying?
Well, I think you're getting to it, which is where does this history, which views the distinction between discovery and invention, is one that, of course, is core to the basic constitutional language with regard to intellectual property. And so today we see kind of a bit of a divergence, which I think you're getting into. So I wanted to jump in with a follow-up question that I think you're getting to anyway. So.
Oh, okay. So I will continue then.
Excellent.
With the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, basically turned things around over a course of several rulings in the mid-90s. And what they came up with was this principle that mathematics, only in the purest darn sense, is going to be non-patentable. So if you take a mathematical algorithm and load it onto a computer using a standard, you know, stock, you know, mathematical programming language and hit run, then you have just built, quote, a new machine, end quote. And as a machine, it is patentable like any other machine. So what we're getting here is the sort of erosion of the distinction between what is mathematical and what is, you know, quotidian real-world hardware. And this did a lot of damage. Now, before the CAFC made these rulings, the Supreme Court had a number...
For the benefit of the listeners, I don't mean to interrupt, Ben. The CAFC is...
It's the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit,
right,
which was founded by our friend Ronald Reagan in the early 80s as one of the first steps of his administration.
And it has exclusive jurisdiction over these issues as a result of its creation. So listeners who may not be familiar just want to be aware of the fact that this is the Court of Appeals to which all of these issues go.
Yeah, thank you. And the only court above them is the Supreme Court, which we'll get to in a few minutes in this narrative. But backing up a little bit, to just before the CAFC was founded, the Supreme Court was hearing patent cases, and they heard three patent cases regarding software. And in all three cases, they came up with a principle that a new machine that uses software but does non-trivial work beyond that, like, you know, curing rubber or what have you, should be patentable. But if you take a piece of information and how did Rehnquist call it? Quote, insignificant post-solution activity, end quote. This should not be patentable. And basically the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit reversed this insignificant post-solution activity principle, or I should say they ignored it, and said, well, insignificant post-solution activity is good enough for us. If you load something onto a computer, then it's a physical device. And the result here in this, this is almost a wording trick. This is all, you know, almost a shady way to get around it, is that any piece of information processing, any piece of math, a price list, a storyline, new words are perfectly patentable. Because, well, once you write the storyline to paper, well, gosh, you've got paper. There used to be a printed matter doctrine that that, yeah, information written on a piece of paper is not patentable. That's just silly, the courts used to think. But it gets harder and harder to defend that printed matter doctrine now that we say that insignificant post-solution activity is patentable. For example, one court of appeals for the Federal Circuit case, In re Lowry, was about a data structure. So a data structure is simply a structured means of writing data. So somebody had come up with a way of writing things to the hard drive in a manner such that it's, you know, more convenient to retrieve later. And this was ruled to be a patentable device.
Hmm.
Now, we can compare this with earlier rulings about pieces of paper with, you know, it sort of tricky, clever rules on them to make accounting easier. Those were ruled to not be patentable by the printed matter doctrine because they're just lines on paper. But once we convert this to the hard drive and say, you know, written to the hard drive, it's a new machine, then, well, why not allow lines on paper?
Right. That history, I think, actually is the most succinct history of this issue that I've heard, so congratulations. And I apologize for jumping in your narrative to lead you where you were going. I was sitting back and listening to it, and I think you covered the ground pretty well. We need to take a short music break. I want to pick up right where you've left off here and look at this issue, because obviously I think the listeners can pick up, even if they didn't know anything about the book, that you do not agree with where the courts are right now. And I want to probe that a little bit more after the music break. So just sit tight. You're listening to KZSU Stanford and Hearsay Culture with Ben Clemens, author of the book Math You Can't Use, Patents, Copyright, and Software. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Before we return with Ben Clemens, this is the time in the show where I start asking for money. So KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station that relies on donations from listeners to continue its broad range of programming. If you're interested in learning more about making a donation, you have a couple of options. You can go to kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can go to the web and email underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And you'll get a response at that point. So regardless, please keep listening to KZSU.
So we're back with Ben Clemens. And Ben, before the music break, you traced the history starting from much earlier than most textbooks that I've seen of patent law. And I want to lead us to today, which is and focus on the problems as you see them. You make the point, and you were making the point here, that software is incompatible with patents. And there's an interesting argument you make in the book, which I'd like to discuss, which is the idea that were patents aggressively enforced in software when the internet was being developed, the internet may not have developed, and indeed today you make the argument that if patents themselves are aggressively enforced, the internet would shut down. Can you explain that?
Well, this gets back to what I'd been saying earlier, that there's no one information industry. There's a server, and you know, run by every business of a certain size everywhere in the country. So if somebody has a patent that they claim you know, reads onto these servers, then they've got a host of targets, and it's a much larger host of targets than in any well-defined industry. So there's a lot that goes into into a server, and it's hard to determine exactly where what would or would not be patentable. And let's say that you, Stanford Radio, got a cease and desist letter from somebody saying, you know, your online streaming violates our patent number, you know, 6,900,000, blah blah blah, and you know, it violates it in the following technical algorithm. What are you going to do? It's not like you can send it to you know, your legal specialists on software patent law, because you don't have one, because you don't think of yourself as a software company.
Although at Stanford we might be able to find someone, but generally lawyers, yeah. I mean, it's not something that lawyers are studying on a regular basis. That's for sure.
Although Acacia Technologies, in an entirely related situation,
right,
is actually suing distance learning programs for universities, and saying that by broadcasting a teacher's, you know, voice and image over the web to students who are elsewhere, that violates their patents.
Hmm.
And, you know, based upon a streaming algorithm, et cetera, et cetera. And, these are some, I could get you the list of universities later. But many of them have law schools, and they still got work to do. And so I would say that a great deal of the problems we're seeing are the breadth issue, the fact that these patents read on every company all across the country. And the same holds for business method patents. Business method patents came very close on the heels of software. If I had to pick one case that invented software patents, it would be In re Allopat, 1994. And everyone points to State Street Bank and Trust, 1998, as when business method patents came to be. And it was the same thing. It said, well, you know, these business method patents, they're technically physical because they involve, you know, money or price lists or furniture arrangements, and therefore these things should be patentable like any other machine or device. And think about the business method industry. You know, which companies use business methods? I think that would be all of them.
Right.
So, again, you have this problem of, a massive industry, just unfathomably massive, who all have to comply with these patents. So let's say you're holding a patent. All you have to do is look around and find somebody somewhere who is infringing your patent. You know, with all the businesses in America potentially infringing, you're guaranteed somebody is going to, you know, be in your direction. And so we're seeing the rise of what are popularly called patent trolls. And there exists a definition which I hate, which I won't bother with now. My definition of a patent troll is somebody who takes advantage of an information disadvantage. So there are other people out there who don't know about the patent and about your patent, and then you go in and sue them and say, ha ha, you didn't know about this, but guess what, you owe me money. And this has become a reasonable business strategy, and there are a number of companies, including Acacia that I had mentioned a few minutes ago, Altitude Capital, Rembrandt IP, Collar Capital, Northwater Capital, ALS Technologies. I'm giving myself a little test here. How many can I name? But I shouldn't bore the listener with this.
So we can blog about it.
Great. So this is one problem that's turned up, and there have been a couple of other problems, like the problem of obviousness, which I'd be happy to discuss later.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these things, all of them stem from the fact that we have this massive industry. That is, you know, all computer users or all business method users. The Supreme Court has made a couple of efforts here in the present day to solve this problem. As noted, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit was founded, and the Supreme Court stepped back and said, okay, you guys have been founded to be sort of the Supreme Court of patents. Get to work. Don't bother us. We have to worry about abortion. And so for about 15, 20 years, they let that slide. But over the last couple of years, there's been so much uproar over patents, so many complaints that the Supreme Court felt the need to step in. And so we've seen a series of cases that handle individual problems that have been perceived about the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit's handling of patents. One of them, the key for the question of software patents, was LabCorp v. Metabolite,
mm-hmm.
which would have directly addressed the question, what is patentable? Is information processing patentable? Unfortunately, there were procedural problems with the case, and so cert was revoked on that case. So the Supreme Court gave no ruling, leaves us hanging.
Right.
Oh, it was such a cliffhanger already. And then we get this ruling. Huh. Tune in next time.
Do you see patents themselves ultimately, and you discuss this in the book, promoting innovation in the software industry? I mean, we have, as you point out, software continues to be developed, and of course the underlying assumption, the underlying basis upon which intellectual property rights derive, is the notion that we need to incentivize its creation. We've seen software itself, as you point out in the book, created despite the fact that patenting, as you mentioned, wasn't something that many early software designers for the internet considered. So where do you see patents in connection with innovation in the software industry?
Well, they don't have much of a place, and I'm actually not the first person to say this. Obviously, I have a bias in a certain direction.
Right.
But other people who have a bias in exactly the opposite direction also have failed to find any relationship. A Mr. Ronald Mann has done both interviews where he talked to venture capitalists and programmers, and he found that they all basically ignore patents. And he's done a couple of more empirically oriented work pieces, and they found no significant effect to patents. And a couple of other folks have made similar attempts, and they've all found no effect. And they get this published through the wonderful spin of saying, as you can see, whatever the effect of patents, they have not killed the software, which I suppose is nice enough. But you know, patents are not intended to fail to hinder the progress of science and the useful arts. They should be actively promoting things.
Right.
I've talked to one guy at Apple via his blog about this very subject. He, one of the lead developers for Apple, I asked him directly, so what has Apple put out that it wouldn't have put out via patents? How have patents helped innovation? And he said, oh, I never said patents promote innovation. I don't think that's really the case. And, you know, this is one of the lead engineers at Apple. And then I know a couple of folks who worked at Microsoft's research department. One of them actually got a patent. I think he has two. He has two patents, which are assigned to Microsoft Inc. Every time a researcher at Microsoft produces a patent, they get $1,000 bonus. So they've got the incentive there. So I ask him, what was your patent for? And he says, oh, it's nothing. It's stupid. Yeah, but, you know, it was original enough that we were able to get a patent. And then he told me that after he got the paperwork in, he bought his boss a copy of Math You Can't Use. So that was nice, though.
Those, that's the kind of anecdata that I think is quite persuasive with regard to these issues.
But I mean, to tell you the truth, I've looked around, I've talked to a lot of people, and I have yet to find somebody, that solid example of, you know, here is a piece of software that would not have existed without patents. And searching the literature, other people, even very pro-patent people, are unable to really point to something. And this isn't the case with, say, pharmaceuticals, right? Most pharmaceutical companies won't even bother with something unless they can get a patent, knowing that they need to invest millions of dollars beforehand and, you know, knowing the market afterward.
It is remarkable, and I think it leads us into, in the remaining time that we have, which unfortunately is never enough time to delve deeply into these issues, but it's basically the issue of deficiencies within the patent application process, and particularly, this is widely known. I've had Mark Lemley on, as well as Josh Lerner from Harvard Business School. I mean, and you know, there's pretty much wide concurrence that there are severe staffing shortages at the PTO, the Patent and Trademark Office, with respect to patent applications. But I wonder, aside from the fact that there simply aren't enough examiners to examine the prior art, and in other ways determine whether something is patentable, whether in your view, with regard to the mathematics, there's an equal deficiency or perhaps greater deficiency with respect to basic knowledge. And I guess it leads me to that question from the prism of the notion that the courts themselves and lawyers, as we've discussed, are not mathematicians, and that the courts, as you point out in the book and you can discuss now, do view math as abstract in some ways as opposed to it as actually applied. Do you think it's possible to get the courts, to get patent examiners, and indeed to get lawyers to understand these kinds of distinctions without becoming computer programmers and taking, you know, the courses necessary to be a computer programmer?
Okay, so first, with regards to, I'll talk about the PTO and then the courts.
Sure.
With regards to the PTO, my impression is that most of the guys who work at the PTO are pretty darn smart. And everyone needs to have, you know, a degree in a technical field, the field that they're going to be working in. And I can't speak for the entire USPTO, but I think that the level of competence is there. Part of the problem, and part of why people are so insulting toward not you, but I've read, you know, many another person who has been very insulting. All those PTO officers, they're all idiots. They're, you know. How could they possibly allow this to pass? Is that basically their hands are tied by the courts, which there's a manual of patent examination procedure, which is the USPTO's understanding of current case law regarding patents, and it's very detailed. It says, you know, you ask this question, ask this question. If the answer is no, then you have to give a patent, etc. And the case law to date has been very, very pro-patent, has made it more and more difficult to disallow patents. And part of this is, you know, the CAFC has shown itself to be, incredibly pro-patent itself. And Jaffe actually wrote a book on this. I'm sure he mentioned Innovation and Its Discontents.
Right, Josh Lerner, his co-author, was on the show, so.
Yeah. So, there's little question that the CAFC has been very pro-patent, and one of the ways they've done this, been pro-patent, is that they've said, okay, you examiners, you can't reject anything. Unless something was actually in the literature, that you found, you know, here's the smoking gun, you know, the prior art, you can't reject anything. And the Supreme Court has recently reversed this in the KSR v. Teleflex case. And they said that basically a person having ordinary skill in the art is not just, you know, ordinarily skilled, they also have ordinary common sense and creativity. And we can expect to see a big uptick in rejections because examiners' hands are no longer tied. This also shows, getting to the courts, a contrast between the Supreme Court, which is very generalist, and, you know, their interest is, you know, the welfare of the world at large and ethical issues that, you know, weigh heavily on their heads, etc., versus this very specialist Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, whose incentive is to have, whose goal is to produce a neatly functioning patent system, regardless of what effect that has on the economy at large. And if we look at policy, there's you can ask, as you know, some courts care about policy, and some courts go out of their way to not think about policy. Now, in the past, in centuries past, we've seen most patent rulings in the book I mentioned, the Morse ruling, discuss policy. They say, well, if we rule that this should be or shouldn't be patentable, how will this affect the progress of science and the useful arts? How will this affect the economy at large? And the Supreme Court has been doing this as well. They're happy to cite, you know, the part of the Constitution that says patents are, quote, to promote the progress of science and useful arts, end quote. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has taken a much more hands-off position, saying the courts should not decide policy. That is not their job. Therefore, our job is to be as obnoxiously literal as possible and just read the law and do what it says.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we're seeing this, this jump from, a court that seems to understand information processing is not, you know, is not equivalent to a stapler. And, you know, the CAFC, which says, well, we don't see a difference. We can't see a difference. And you see this in their attempts to standardize patent jurisdiction as much as possible and remove any sort of human, you know, judgment calls. And you see it in their sort of pro-patent bias that says, well, the Constitution didn't say anything about software not being allowable. Therefore, it should be.
Ben, in the remaining few minutes that we have, about 3 minutes, I do want to give you a brief opportunity to kind of, in light of the problems that you identify with regard to mathematics ultimately being patented, what are your policy prescriptions in a nutshell to solve the problem?
Well, we need a return. Ideally, we would get a return back to the days when you needed more than a trivial physical step for something to be patentable. And allowing that would basically eliminate software patents, the great majority of software patents. Some software patents really are half hardware, half software. And, you know, business method patents, storyline patents, patents on words, etc. Also notable are tax loophole patents, which are a recent invention. There have only been a dozen or so granted to date, again, because the examiners have no ability to reject them. However, tax law patents, they affect lawyers. So there's been much lobbying and much effective lobbying. There's a bill on the Hill now regarding getting rid of this one little thing. I've seen the wording of the bill, and it's not going to help much in that either you can write it broadly and say that software that handles a tax loophole of any sort should be barred, in which case you won't be able to patent any, you know, tax act, tax cut, or what have you. Or you could write it narrowly, in which case people will be able to circumvent it by writing software. How much time do I have?
Oh, yeah, we have about another three minutes or so, and if you could work in, I hate to do this at the end because we don't have a lot of time, but maybe very briefly in 30 seconds, the political atmosphere that you've experienced on the Hill.
Not much is happening, and here's why. In fact, since the inception of software patents, not much has been happening, and not much will be able to happen, because up until that date, patents were kind of pharma's baby, and patent bills were basically sort of an attempt to appease pharmaceutical companies because they were mostly affected by it and, you know, mostly benefited by it, from it. But now software has been told, okay, you guys, your stuff is patentable now. And a lot of software guys really want a weakening of patent law because they're horrified by this and they want it to go away. And so they're lobbying, you know, throwing money at congressmen saying, you know, we want a weaker patent law. The pharma people are continuing to say, well, we need a strong patent law. It benefits us. Why are we changing something that's worked for us for a century? And so we get gridlock. And we've seen this in a number of bills that have turned up and just been killed very shortly thereafter from one coalition on one side or one coalition on the other. And so we can kind of expect a continued gridlock there. I think our big hope in getting out of that gridlock is for the Supreme Court to take on a replacement for the ill-fated LabCorp v. Metabolite case. Hmm. And my personal prediction is we're not going to see much happening until that occurs.
Well, on that, I guess cautiously optimistic note, in the sense that you can see that there is a solution. I have talked to a few people who are much more pessimistic in the possibilities that these things can be solved. But I want to thank you, Ben, for being on the show today and discussing these issues. Like I said, it's as a lawyer dealing with law, I have enormous regard for non-lawyers that delve, especially at the depth that you have, into these issues. And so I appreciate you coming on today to discuss your book, Math You Can't Use, Patents, Copyright, and Software.
Thanks for having me.
Steely Dan Classic, Ricky, don't lose that number. Ben Clemens, the author of Math You Can't Use, Patents, Copyright, and Software, has written a book that I think covers these issues quite well. And like I said, from the perspective of a mathematician, he goes into a level of detail that unfortunately we just don't have the time to do on the show. But going through the history, as Ben was mentioning, of not only patents, but also the mathematics behind the creation of technology is really quite fascinating, and I would love to have Ben back in the future to kind of get into that history in more detail. But as we await, as we await and look for cases to deal with these issues on the patent side, and given the number of Supreme Court cases that have come up in the last year, I think it's a topic worthy of today's discussion. This show is being recorded in late May, and you won't be hearing the show until the summer. Which warrants some explanation. Over the summer, I am working on preparing to be an assistant professor at Charlotte School of Law, which includes teaching two classes that I've never taught before. It is quite time intensive on top of my own writing. So as a result, I'm recording a number of shows in late May and early June to be aired over the summer, and I'm attempting to assure the timeliness of each. You can find the shows and the podcast of portions of them by going to a number of places. You can go to cyberlaw.stanford.edu and go to the podcast feed. You can also go to the iTunes webpage for the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Or, finally, you can go to hearsayculture.com, which is the website dedicated to the show. And in there you can find all the previous shows as well as the schedule of upcoming guests. So you're listening to KZSU, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. I want to thank you for listening in today, and I look forward to talking to you next week.